Welcome. Grab your favorite morning beverage and join us for Morning Cannolis with Jim Santel. You don't know me, but I'm your brother. Sampling the news desserts of the week, here is your host, Jim Santel.
Good morning, America. Good morning, Wisconsin, the great Midwest, cities, towns, villages throughout our area. My name is Jim Santel. I'm here with you on this bright and beautiful Saturday morning in downtown Waukesha. I'm at the WAUK radio studios, the Shaw in Waukesha, 540 AM, 101 FM. I'm joined here in the studios this morning, as always, by my producer, Connor. Delighted to have him with me. And thanking once again Mike Kruth, the owner-operator of this wonderful radio station, for affording me this opportunity to come into your lives and spend some time in discussion with you every Saturday morning from 9 to 11, including this morning when our agenda is ambitious, but as always, achievable. We'll chat about that in just a moment. It is Saturday, July 30th, 2022. This is the 211th day of our calendar year. As always, we begin with some history to start off our discussion, our time together this morning. And we recall that a number of very significant things happen in contemporary life in America, and many things in ancient history happened as well. On this day in history, in the year 762, the modern city of Baghdad, where I spent some time back in 2006 to 2008, was founded, and its present location right along the Tigris River there in the middle of the Iraqi nation in Mesopotamia. 1729, jumping ahead about 1,000 years, a city in this country, in the United States of America, was founded. The city of Baltimore was founded on this day in 1729. We chat a lot about academics and books, as we're going to do today. Today is also an important day in the history of books. In 1935, it was the time that the first Penguin books in paperback were published for America. 10 different books, different varieties, many of them still classics to this day, 1935. The first paperbacks in America, a tradition that continues to this day. 1945, a very sober and somber event happened. The USS Indianapolis went down in the Pacific Ocean. About 880 crew members died in that, including many who were lost to the shark-infested waters. As we know from history, USS Indianapolis going down in 1945. 1965, President Lyndon Baines Johnson signs the Medicare bill, became effective in 1966. 1971 was the year on this day, July 30th, that Apollo 15 landed on the moon. Apollo 15 on this day in 1971. A couple of more significant events. It was on this day in 2018, not that long ago, when Malaysian Airlines 370 disappeared, and the investigation still unsolved to this day. Continued, began that day, continuing to this day to try to figure out what happened to the victims of that plane crash someplace in the Pacific Ocean, presumably. And in 2020, also a somber day in American history, in national history, in international history as well. We recognize the significant contributions of former congressman and civil rights advocate John Lewis. His funeral, his memorial service, was held this day on 2020. And as we know, John Lewis, not only this civil rights icon in American history, but also his name is attached to this day to some of the major pieces of legislation that are attempted to correct the decisions of the United States Supreme Court in a couple of cases that basically eviscerated the Voting Rights Act of 1965, a case called Shelby County, another one called Brnovich from just last year. We've chatted about those as well. Today was the day back in 2020, 2 years ago, and we thought about John Lewis, his legacy in America. Former President Barack Obama delivered the eulogy on that day. So today, once again, Saturday, July 30th, 2022. Thank you so much for joining me, spending a couple of hours with me this morning, or whatever time your calendar, your schedule today permits. As I said, we do have an ambitious but much achievable agenda. I'm going to spend the first hour or so following up on the second component, the second wave, if you will, of the discussion that we began last Saturday, talking about academics, talking about the importance of the First Amendment in our nation to this day. And the second hour, we're also going to chat about the First Amendment, more broadly speaking, and its aspect when it comes to religion. And in particular, we're going to be talking about an upcoming anniversary. This week, it was August 5th, 2012, that a gunman walked into the Sikh Gurdwara in our neighboring community in Oak Creek, right here in southeastern Wisconsin, and killed 7 people and injured many more, and changed the life and the livelihood and the arc of our community, our state, and also our nation, our world. And all of those are going to be looking to southeastern Wisconsin and the Gurdwara in Oak Creek, Wisconsin, this coming weekend. Friday is the 10-year anniversary, the 10-year observance of the horrific hate crimes violence at the Sikh Gurdwara that took those lives, injured many more. But nonetheless, in the spirit of Chardi Kala, which we will chat about in our second hour this coming Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, the community, broadly speaking, the membership, the leadership of the Sikh Gurdwara is going to be observing solemnly, but also drawing lessons, talking about the events of that horrific morning, Sunday, August 5th of 2012, and then also drawing some lessons from what we know today about not only shootings and violence, all too frequent, all too common in the United States of America. Also chatting, however, about the ascendancy that has come from that, from the community, from the nation, from the state, from all of us who took from that horrific experience some things about humanity and the ways in which we come together, even in the midst of terrible tragedy, to move forward and think about the future. Young people, middle-aged people, older people. We're going to chat a lot about that in the second hour this morning here on Morning Cannolis at WAUK, the Shaw in downtown Waukesha. And as always, we're going to be taking your questions, your comments, your thoughts throughout the two-hour period at 844-967-2789. That number once again, 844-967-2789. Welcoming, as always, your thoughts, your comments, your questions. Connor is at the wheel, and he will be directing your comments and questions to me. Looking forward to chatting with you this morning in Waukesha. So let's begin. Let's begin the second portion of our discussion about a First Amendment issue established by people like George Mason and James Madison many years ago, 1789, ratified by the states in 1791. What do we know about Article 1, the first article of the Bill of Rights in our Constitution, one of 27 amendments to our Constitution? It says Congress, and by that the courts have understood that to mean any federal government, state government, local government, government generally, shall make no law, shall do nothing respecting an establishment of religion or prohibiting the free exercise thereof or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. And again, we're going to be chatting mostly about freedom of speech this morning, talking a lot also in our second hour about freedom of religion and the capacity not only of the Sikh faith to observe their faith, but people of all faiths and of all affiliations with churches and synagogues, temples, and mosques around our nation, throughout the world, to observe their faiths as they feel appropriate. The First Amendment establishing those fundamental rights to speech, to discussion, to exchange in the common practice of engaging with other people about ideas, concepts that are important to us, and prompted this entire discussion, which we began last week, about academics and the rights that students and teachers have inside the academic setting, prompted by three things. One is, of course, as we know well, the start of the new school year for most schools in Wisconsin and many others around the nation, going back to school in late August, to some in early September, about a month from now. So that's one of the initiating prompts that encourages us to talk about academics and the First Amendment last time and again today. We're also very much in mind of the recent Supreme Court case in a case called Kennedy versus Bremerton. This is the
litigation and the decision by a majority of the Supreme Court that seized upon the first article of the Bill of Rights that establishes the freedom of religion and also prohibits the establishment of religion, found that this coach in Seattle, Washington, did in fact have a constitutional right to engage in prayer at the 50-yard line of a football field after the game, along with probably 10, 15, 20, 25, 30 of his team members. A very notorious and famous case now because of the visuals on that. Supreme Court finding that indeed under the first article, the first of the Bill of Rights, that he does, that coach does have the right to pray in that setting, even in a public school, in a public setting, and said that the decisions by the school and the school board and the school entities, the superintendent, to discipline him for, from their perspective, violating, if you will, the separation of church and state, a position that they advocated for effectively and very, very vigorously before the Supreme Court, that their concerns about that establishment were actually overtaken by the Supreme Court's articulation of this view that the coach himself had a right of freedom of expression and freedom of exercise of his religion, permitted to pray in that setting, prompting an awful lot of people to look at that case and think, gosh, what about the prohibitions of prayer and Bible reading, for example, in schools, in public schools to this day? We'll chat about that again in a little bit. And indeed, in the wake of that particular case of a couple of weeks ago, blurring, if you will, from many perspectives, this distinction between church and state. We know that in Michigan, there's a superintendent pondering whether coaches should lead students in prayer. In Florida, there's a school board member who wants her district to teach students about prayer and offer religious studies. In Hawaii, the leader of a faith and family-focused activism group is looking for an alteration in state policy on the initiation of prayer and on campus. So that, too, prompting a lot of our discussion this morning. And finally, another discussion out of Maine, likewise addressing this issue. We're going to be talking about all of that right after the break. Join us here at WAUK, the Shaw, 101 FM, 540 AM, 844-967-2789. We're back. This is Jim Santel at the studios of WAUK Radio in downtown Waukesha. Thanks so much for joining me this morning. A bright and beautiful morning in Waukesha. We're chatting this morning in our first hour about academics in America, the First Amendment rights to freedom of speech and expression, and we're mindful of a number of cases coming out of the United States Supreme Court in which the court most recently said once again that the First Amendment's protections extend to teachers and students alike, neither of whom shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gate. Right before the break, we were chatting about a couple of those cases coming out of the state of Washington and also the state of Maine. We know that right here in Waukesha County, we also have an issue related to academics as we go into the new academic year. It happens to be in the city of Muskego, right here in Waukesha. A wonderful community, about 24,000 people, the fifth largest community in Waukesha County. There, as many of us know, there is a dispute. There is a disagreement. There is a lot of advocacy for the teaching of a book written by Julie Otsuka called When the Emperor Was Divine. It has to do with the internment of Japanese American citizens during World War II in internment camps in the western portions of our nation, and describes in particular that experience suffered by members of our Asian American community that time,
a novel that has a story, an account that has gotten an awful lot of awards and was previously on the reading list for the Muskego High School English class. The superintendent and the school board and other leaders in the Muskego Norway School District have taken that book off of the curriculum for the coming school year, prompting a lot of disagreement, a lot of discussion, including a major protest just this past week. About 150 community members gathering at the Muskego Educational Service Center in Wisconsin to protest the school board's decision to ban, again, Julie Otsuka's award-winning 2002 novel, When the Emperor Was Divine. And so we are thoughtful, we're mindful of that issue as well in our own community, having to do with freedom of expression, freedom of access to information in our schools, our public schools, and other places of learning and instruction and growth. And so that is what prompts both last week and again for the remainder of our hour this morning, our first hour this morning, our discussion about what the Supreme Court has said about freedom of expression, freedom of access to materials, and the right to have those freedoms expressed and pursued in our academic settings. We talked at great length last Saturday, about what the First Amendment does in fact say and chatted about these distinctions between, for example, protected and unprotected speech, and noted there are certain things that are not protected by the First Amendment. Those include things like fighting words and threats of violence and so forth, child pornography, which of course are not inside the protections of the First Amendment. Freedom of expression and speech and so forth. And then there's also this distinction between content-based speech and content-neutral speech. Content-neutral restrictions that have to do with the time and place and the circumstances under which speech can be delivered. Content-based speech, of course, is the content itself, the substance of what is being said. The Supreme Court has basically said that you can make distinctions, for the most part, based upon content-neutral considerations. And as we talked last week, we found that generally, schools, public schools are in fact are certainly public forums, but they're non-public forums in the sense that inside those institutions, all the full trappings that you would have in a fully public forum, like a park or on a street or a sidewalk in America, they do not attach. And so, one of the questions we began to ask last week was, how are schools classified, including this non-public forum approach? And then how do we figure out what is in fact permitted inside of public schools to these days and what is not? Again, thinking not only about Muskego, but also about schools in the state of Washington and Maine, other places around our nation. Also noting, of course, that there are these distinctions between publicly funded institutions and privately supported institutions, which are not, for the most part, covered by the First Amendment, and for that reason, also an important distinction to make. And so, as we were finishing up last week, we were chatting about a number of different cases in which the Supreme Court has defined some of this, told us what this all means. We recall well the case of Burnett, West Virginia versus Burnett in 1943, a 6-3 vote that overturned a state law in West Virginia that required all public school students to salute the flag and recite the Pledge of Allegiance. Again, in a public school, the Supreme Court says you cannot do that. Justice Jackson talking about this notion of free speech in our schools being a fixed star in our constitutional constellation. Again, a very important case way back in 1943. We talked again, as I made mention earlier, of these two very, very significant landmark cases in the 1960s. 1962, a case called Engel versus Vitale, in which the Supreme Court once again prohibited state laws that mandated prayer in school. That was 1962. And then 1 year later, in Abington School District versus Shep, finding that the public organized reading of the Bible in schools was contrary to the Constitution. Again, not that you can't do that as an individual if you choose to do so, but it's the institutionalized, the very public and the very authorized doing of that praying and reading from the Bible and presumably other books of religious origin. And then in 1968, a few years later, in a case called Epperson versus Arkansas, the High Court also found that a state law that banned the teaching of evolution in public schools was a violation of the Establishment Clause. And finally, as we were breaking last Saturday, we were chatting about this case called Tinker versus Des Moines Independent School District, 1969, in which this fundamental notion, again, I'll repeat it once again because it is so important, hardly be argued that either students or teachers shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech or expression at the schoolhouse gates. We chatted about this material notion that the young woman, who was Mary Beth Tinker at the time, way back in 1968, 1969, wanted to organize a protest to the Vietnam War, did so. The Supreme Court supported her and said, indeed, that does not impose a material or substantive interference on the process of education, and found that she had that right inside the public schools to protest in that way, contrary to what the superintendent and the school board said about all of that. When we come back, we'll chat about a couple more cases and then turn more recently to some very recent decisions of the Supreme Court with respect to the student rights inside our public schools in America. Stay with us. WAUK The Shaw. This is Morning Cannolis. We're taking your calls at 844-967-2789. Once again, Jim Santel, Morning Cannolis. We're chatting in this first hour of our time together about academics in the United States of America, right here in Waukesha, other places around the country. We're chatting right before the break about this course of Supreme Court cases, including Tinker, in which the Supreme Court said that teachers and students do not, in fact, shed their constitutional rights to freedom of speech when they move through the schoolhouse gate. And talking in specific about this case involving Mary Beth Tinker, who was 13 years old at the time that she organized a protest of the Vietnam War. The Supreme Court saying, no, that does not, in fact, accomplish a material or substantive interference with the conduct of academic pursuits in that school district, permitting her to go ahead. And so in the wake of Tinker, what happened? What was the course of conduct after Tinker by the United States Supreme Court and beyond? Well, the United States Supreme Court began to reject some student claims under the First Amendment, emphasizing what it described the role of public schools in inculcating values and promoting civic virtues. So we know, for example, that in 1968, almost contemporaneous with Tinker, the High Court did in fact find that school officials can decide on some specific curricular topics and other student expression when it occurs, for example, in assembly. That was the case of Bethel School District versus Frazier in 1968. And also, perhaps even more interesting, the Supreme Court said in a case, a very important case called Hazelwood versus Kuhlmeyer in 1988, a couple of decades later, that in fact a school district does have the school officials, principals, school officials, and school board members have some authority when it comes to the content of school and student newspapers, could in fact do some censoring, if you will, some decision making about what is and is not in student newspapers. Again, that was Hazelwood. All of this respect to students in schools. And so we've got some more recent cases. 2007, about 15 years ago, in a case called Morris versus Frederick, fairly colorful case. again, coming out of our United States Supreme Court on this question of what students can and cannot do under the First Amendment in public schools. Supreme Court said that public school officials could indeed prohibit student speech that they reasonably thought would promote illegal drug use. And Supreme Court said, no, you can, in fact, limit some of the expressions there. In this case, a banner in the school arguably promoting illegal drug use. Supreme Court saying you can limit that in the First Amendment without running afoul of the protections in that first article of the Bill of Rights. And then, interestingly, going, if not necessarily in the opposite direction, but a different set of facts, in 2021, just last year, a fairly notorious case called Mahoney Area School District versus BL, BL, the initials of a young woman who was a cheerleader, and she was upset about the fact that she was not selected to serve on the varsity cheerleading team, went out and placed on her social media posts some vulgar objections to that decision not to go ahead with her placement on the varsity team. The question was whether or not the school district could sanction her, could prohibit her from being on the team entirely. And just last year, 2021, once again, the Supreme Court went, if you will, in the opposite direction, said, you know what, because she was doing this off campus, social media, not necessarily quite right inside the school confines, if you will, that they could not, in fact, discipline her. And so it was a statement in support of her rights under the First Amendment, even to say something vulgar, even to say something that's very contrary to the perhaps the best interest from the school district's perspective of their position. But nonetheless, a wonderful expression of the possibilities and the options that stay with students inside the schools with respect to the First Amendment. We've got, admittedly, a bit of a mixed bag out there, but nonetheless, a very clear articulation, once again, that students inside public schools do have free speech rights. They vary depending upon the type of expression that is, the location of it, its impact, all kinds of things that the Supreme Court takes into consideration in deciding those cases. And all of those, again, with respect to students in our public schools. Next question, of course, is what about teachers? What about teachers? We talked before about this matter in Muskego, and teachers interested in teaching this award-winning book having to do with the internment of Asian Americans during World War II. Can teachers do that? Can students read that book in a public setting, in that public venue, a very organized way? And so many of these issues very much at play right here in Waukesha County. And you'll not be surprised to learn that the Supreme Court relies a lot on the student cases to figure out what the rights of teachers are, the rights of teachers. And they are somewhat more limited, but nonetheless, as the Supreme Court has said, again repeated recently in the Bremerton High School football coach case, that teachers also do not shed their First Amendment rights when they walk through the schoolhouse doors. And so the question is, what are those rights? How far do they go? Are they the same as they would attach to students? And as I indicated, a little bit different, but nonetheless, a lot of the same principles apply. No doubt also that when it comes to teachers and indeed students, as you move from public schools, K through 12, and into colleges and universities, the Supreme Court, for the most part, says more liberties, more expression permitted because of the nature of colleges and universities, a little bit more locked down, if you will, in high schools and in the grades before that. But in a case called Pickering versus Board of Education, 1968, probably one of the first times that the Supreme Court wrestled, again, at the same time it's wrestling with the rights of students under the First Amendment, a Supreme Court justice, again, an icon named Thurgood Marshall, had a lot to say about the rights of teachers under the First Amendment. The petitioning teacher in that case had been dismissed by her school district for authoring a letter to the editor of a local newspaper. She was being critical of the school board for its allocations of monies, its public funds, between academics and athletics, complaining basically sports getting too much, academics not getting enough. She authored this letter into the public domain, published in a local newspaper, critical of the school district, of the school board, superintendent. The question is, can she do that? She is employed by the school district. She's a teacher there. What about her First Amendment rights? How far do they go? How do they attach? And Thurgood Marshall, in one of the great articulations of the rights of teachers also, like those of students in America, said this. He said, the interest of the school administration in limiting teachers' opportunities to contribute to public debate is not greater than its interest in limiting a similar contribution by any member of the general public. Now, that may sound a little bit serpentine, a little bit circuitous, if you will, in its description. Basically, what the Supreme Court, what Justice Marshall was saying then is, you know, teachers, when it comes to these kinds of expressions, again, do not shed their rights, pretty much the same as the general public, perhaps in publishing a letter in the local newspaper, being critical of a community school board. And so really leveling the playing field in this case called Pickering. Pickering versus Board of Education, 1968. And sure enough, Pickering does have some precedential impact following up on that particular year. And in 1979, about 11 years later, in a case called Givhan, G-I-V-H-A-N versus Western Line Consolidated School District, at that time, the Supreme Court reinstated, put back in place, put back in litigation, a First Amendment claim of an educator, a teacher in the state of Mississippi. That teacher had been discharged, again dismissed, after complaining to her principal about racial discrimination in the school district. So she complains to her school leadership about the fact that people of color are not being given the same opportunities, which they should in fact be given, of course, as we know well, under Brown versus Board of Education. And the Supreme Court says, you know what, once again, the school teacher does not lose her free speech rights simply because she chose to speak on an issue of public concern to her employer directly rather than to the public at large. Makes this somewhat curious distinction between public exposition and private exposition. Says no, in fact, the teacher does have that right, again, following up on Pickering. And then we also have this issue about discipline of teachers. In case involving a Hazelwood, once again, coming back from the student side of the ledger. And right after the break, we're going to chat about what that means. What about discipline imposed upon teachers who might have some obligations inside the classroom? Not just letters, not just things said in the public domain. What about teachers' responsibilities of free speech inside the classroom? Right after the break, we'll chat about the implications of Hazelwood, the student case, when it comes to teacher rights under the First Amendment, right here at WAUK The Shaw. Morning Cannolis. Join us after the break, 844-967-2789, as we continue this discussion this morning of all of these issues under the First Amendment of the United States Constitution. Back once again in our final segment of this first hour on Morning Cannolis. We're chatting, talking this morning about the First Amendment, and in particular, the rights that's still attached to students and most recently now teachers in public schools. We were talking right before the break about this all-important case called Pickering, in which Thurgood Marshall said that the interest of school administrators in limiting teachers' opportunities to talk about things in public debate is not greater than that with respect to people in the public domain generally, non-teachers. And so the question is, what does that mean in practical terms? What does that mean for teachers in America today? We know, once again, reaching back to our previous discussion, that in a case called Hazelwood, the Supreme Court said that with respect to students, that administrators and principals, school districts can in fact censor, can in fact limit what appears in student newspapers. And in fact, in the wake of Pickering, this very broad statement about the rights of teachers to speak out and to have their First Amendment rights understood and supported in public schools, the courts began to go somewhat in the opposite direction. And in particular, used Hazelwood for example, in one of the Court of Appeals in the Eighth Circuit to find that indeed a school district could impose some discipline upon a teacher. In that particular case, a case called LAX, L-A-C-K-A-K-S, versus Ferguson Reorganized School District, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, again, this is not the Supreme Court, but the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, using the decision in Hazelwood, the student case about newspapers, said that the school district could, in fact, fire a Missouri teacher for failing to censor her school students in the classroom. And the Eighth Circuit at that time said a flat prohibition on profanity in the class is reasonably related to a reasonable pedagogical concern, and for that reason, that promotes some generally acceptable social and academic standards. There's a legitimate academic and educational purpose in doing that, and so used Hazelwood, again, this student case, applied it to teachers and found that indeed there are some limits on what teachers can or cannot do inside the classroom, found that that particular school district in Missouri could indeed sanction the school teacher for not properly censoring her students inside her classroom. And in the wake of that, again, we've got this question then about which standard applies. Is it Hazelwood or is it this Pickering case? And again, which Thurgood Marshall said, you know, you've got an awful lot of teachers who do have rights under the First Amendment, and those rights should be observed. Well, we've got a little bit of additional insight. In 1991, a few years after the case was decided previously, a case called Miles versus Denver Public Schools, the Tenth Circuit, another appeals court, not the Supreme Court, concluded that a public school teacher there could be sanctioned for talking about declining discipline and spreading a rumor about a student's intimate conduct on a tennis court. So again, education inside the classroom, conduct inside the classroom, things the teacher said, and the Tenth Circuit, again, not the Supreme Court, but an appeals court, using Hazelwood, said that because of the special characteristics of a classroom environment, Hazelwood and the limitations, the possibilities of administrators imposing discipline, those hold. And we specifically find that the teacher's classroom expression and their exhibition of their First Amendment rights can, in fact, be limited because, indeed, there's a legitimate academic purpose in doing that. And this particular kind of speech by teachers should not be permitted. And so again, a little bit of a difference in direction between Hazelwood and Pickering. Another variation on all of this comes out of a case unrelated to academics, but a case in 2006 called Garcetti by the Supreme Court, that said that public employees do not retain First Amendment protections for speech as a component of their official job duties. Well, teachers in the public setting plainly are public employees. And the question is, does Garcetti, which really wasn't an academic case, wasn't really a school case, does that apply? Does that mean that it basically wipes out Pickering and says that what Thurgood Marshall said about the capacity of teachers to speak and to be open under the First Amendment, was that wiped out? And yet the Supreme Court, even in that case, recognized that its limitations might be real, the limitations of Garcetti in the academic setting as to teachers. And so the majority in that case acknowledged that this raises some other concerns. They've specifically said there is an argument that expression related to academic scholarship or classroom instruction implicates additional constitutional interests that are not fully accounted for by this court's customary employee speech jurisprudence, a long and perhaps very complicated way of saying, you know what, we've got to think about this more, and maybe that public employee limitation does not imply that school teachers can be disciplined and should be sanctioned if, in fact, the school administrators feel they have somehow run afoul of rules and regulations. And so we've got, again, this somewhat mixed bag about what's coming out of the Supreme Court and courts of appeals. Our own Court of Appeals in 2016, in a case called Brown versus Chicago Board of Education, said that the teacher had no First Amendment protection from discipline. The teacher there had been disciplined for using an offensive racial slur as an illustration in a fairly well-intentioned lecture, instructing students not to use that slur. And the Court of Appeals in Chicago, again, the Seventh Circuit, which covers Wisconsin and Indiana and Illinois, basically says because of Garcetti, this public employee prohibition, the teacher's free speech claim fails right out of the gate, the appeals court said. And so, once again, language in the academic setting, not necessarily clear with respect to what we would do going forward, but we do know. We do know, once again, as the Supreme Court recently said in the Bremerton case, that teachers do not, in fact, shed their First Amendment rights when they walk into the school district, when they walk into the school buildings and take responsibility for their classes. Probably a very broad distinction between things that are done right inside the classroom, words, expressions, things that are engaged in with students, and a distinction made perhaps between things done outside, letters to an editor, for example, comments to a supervisor about discrimination in the schools, things that are not done right inside the academic setting itself. Those, it seems, that the Supreme Court will give an awful lot of protection to. More possibilities for supervisors, school boards, principals, others to impose limitations upon teachers for things that they may say and that they may do inside the classroom itself when students are there. And again, this case out of the Eighth Circuit called Lax, probably the best example of that, implying that Hazelwood does in fact limit, if you will, the rights of teachers when it comes to their First Amendment rights. And so we know that there is indeed a First Amendment right of teachers, certainly of students inside classrooms. And we know as well that there are other nations on the face of the planet that likewise wrestle with these issues on a regular basis. We know, for example, that the United Nations itself, in taking a look at not only what we do here in the United States of America, but in other countries around the world, has said in its Declaration of Human Rights, said this: everyone has the right to freedom of opinion and expression. This right, the United Nations has said, includes freedom to hold opinions without interference and to seek, receive, and impart information through any media and regardless of frontiers. That, of course, the United Nations exposition of what we would regard as the First Amendment right under the Constitution of the United States of America, free expression, freedom of the press, also a part of that. And we also know the First Amendment chocked full of these very important rights written by James Madison and others in the first years of our nation, also conveys with it this right of freedom of religious exercise, along with the prohibition on the government to establish a religion. And so as we conclude our first hour this morning and talking about academics, we look forward to the next hour and our discussion in another setting, a much more somber setting, about this event that happened in southeastern Wisconsin on August 5th of 2012. We're going to be talking more about the exercise of religion, the possibility and the right given to all Americans of all faiths to exercise their faiths as they choose without involvement of the government, and also should be free from violence, right? Free from the people who would try to stop them, to try to inhibit that free exercise of religion. We know that 10 years ago, right about now, on August 5th of 2012, we know well that a gunman, a white supremacist, walked into the Sikh Gurdwara in Oak Creek, right here in Wisconsin, and tried to limit the freedom of expression, freedom of religion, the expression of the Sikh faith by the members of the congregation there at the Gurdwara, which is the temple in Oak Creek, and killed 7 members of that congregation. 6 of them on that day, another who survived for a long period of time and more recently died, injured many others at that time as well. And as a result of that, in the coming week, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, our state, our community,
our nation and indeed our world is going to be thinking again, not only about the First Amendment, this important right of all peoples, should they choose to do so, to exercise their freedom of religion as they may elect, of all faiths in this nation, and the freedom to do that without interference, not only by the government, but also from others who would try to stop them from doing that. This coming weekend, once again, an observance of all of those principles when we think about the people who were killed, who were murdered at that time, and also the lessons learned. And so in our second hour, coming up in just a few minutes, we're going to chat more about the observance coming up here in just a few days of the Sikh Gurdwara, the civil rights importance of that issue for America, for Wisconsin, for the entire world. So join us.